Hello everyone, welcome to Cyber Inspiration Podcast. My name is Evgeny. I have been around cybersecurity for the last 20 years and I have a lot of experience working with a variety of cybersecurity vendors. My main work is vendor consulting and cybersecurity advisory for companies. As part of my passion in technology and cyber, I've been intrigued to learn how a company starts. I started the podcast to understand the thinking process and what motivated people to start their own company. This podcast is affiliated with Security Architecture Podcast.
I have a pleasure today to talk with As from Sapienta. As, can you please tell me about your company and what you guys do?
All right. Hi there. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm really grateful to be here. I started Sapienta a few years back, mainly because I was already an entrepreneur. I was already focused on solving a bunch of different problems in network security. And through chatting with my clients at the time and through creating different products at the time for them, I figured that maybe my products are not solving the absolute core problem that they were having. Back at the time, I was making what we call the unified threat management device called the R1. And we were like knee deep into it. We've already raised a lot of money. We've already bought the trademarks. We had the manufacturer. And it was like a network defense and response kind of device or solution. And we were like really knee deep into it. But towards the middle of our scaling of that business, it was just like super hard to miss that people were really focused on the correlation piece of the alerts. They would always say, you know what, these alerts, like, how do I connect them with this other thing? We tried to fix that problem with a few different solutions. We tried to give them like a SIM on top of it, similar to the XDR model, where we would give like a product, like a sensor and a SIM. We tried to make the product somehow integrate with other things. We tried to make it super unified in terms of format. We're trying to focus on making everything in threat intelligence format so that it would be easier later on with other things. We even launched a whole threat intelligence marketplace for them to utilize at the time on the Hyperledger. But essentially what we figured is just wanted to solve the biggest problem they had. They were fine buying different solutions, smaller problems, but the biggest problem they always had was actually connect. And it was like so hard to miss that we decided we'll actually pivot the whole thing. And we just focus on that teeny tiny piece. And that's how we started Sapienta about 4 years back.
It's interesting what you're saying, because you guys started, you like the COVID companies, correct? You started during COVID. And you also mentioned that you had an UTM device. So I had the pleasure to actually test one of the first UTMs ever. I was working at Checkpoint back in the day, and I was testing HTTP, SMTP, POP3, FTP, like really in the beginning how the protocol is working. So I'm very attached to this topic in network security as well. But I guess during COVID, nobody cared about hardware. Everybody wanted something else. So it makes total sense. And you touch on several points that you usually ask people, like what was the motivation? And you mentioned, okay, you wanted to solve different problems. But I guess the question here, what did you do? Did you went to your existing customers that already used your solution? Did you went to the new customers to understand the problem? Or did you just went to people and say, hey, what is your biggest problem? Like walk me through the understanding how you found what is the problem you need to solve for people.
At the time, our biggest customers were MSSPs and essentially system integrators and value-added resellers. Because when you're selling a hardware device, you really need the distributor. You can't really afford doing direct sales in the beginning. So we were essentially focused on interacting with these kind of people. And these kind of people didn't give us that much feedback, to be completely honest. SIs, VARs, MSSPs, unless they're like really passionate about what they do, they usually don't give you real feedback from the customers because they're probably not using it as much other than maybe specific MSSPs that are like operating SOC as a service or MDR as a service. Then these kind of people, if they're really deep into what they do and that's actually the core business, they might be able to give you some feedback. Other than that, the feedback was very limited in the beginning from these kind of customers. As we scaled our business, and as we started thinking, you know what, let's do direct sales. We can actually cover a lot more grounds by doing more direct sales. And we would go out and we would sell to small companies. We would sell to medium companies. And as we started branching off and I started knocking the doors of really big companies, and somehow we were big enough that we were able to actually get meetings with the big companies, only then did we get finally some proper deep customer validation. And it was an interesting problem because we thought we had customer validation. You usually assume that customer validation stops in the early stages. because you already did the survey, you already had the Google Venture Sprints, you already had 500 people sign up your product, you've already sold at least $1 million off revenue. Like, how could you not have cost validation? That's ridiculous.
As every new and agile business, we know how to adapt on the fly. So we just moved to a different spot because we want to have a better audio. So let's continue talking about customers and understanding what customer wants.
Yes, we've noticed that sometimes when you do customer validation in cybersecurity, you always end up validating that there is a problem. In our case, the problem that we validated in the early days was the network detection and response could have been better, a lot better. There's so much open source that people are not using. We could really drive the complexity down. We could really drive the cost down as well. And we thought that these were the biggest problems at the time. But as we found bigger and bigger customers, we were coming closer to what we would call real problems. People could have swallowed the pill of having expensive network detection and response. People can swallow the pill of complex network detection and response. But people were really, really aching when it comes to the problem of connecting the dots and correlation. At the time, we came across a different problem with threat intelligence sharing, the whole threat intelligence format. We jumped across the Stix format. We were giving essentially subscriptions to this intelligence marketplace where machines that could exchange threat intelligence on the fly. And we thought that this would be a much bigger problem than we thought. But again, that also took us back to connecting the dots and correlation at the bigger companies. And it was a very tough leadership call at the time. I went on so many walks in the park with so many mentors. But it was one of these moments where should I solve like a small problem or should I solve like a much bigger problem, a small problem that I'm closer to already establishing a real solution to and I can exit quickly, or do I pivot and almost start from scratch? And it was like one of these moments where I was like, oh, the problem is a much more critical problem. It would give me more satisfaction as an engineer almost to solve.
Did you when to raise money after that, or you had some capital you can go and use it?
We raised more money, but it was so much easier. One of the reasons that was the case was because we submitted an MVP to a DoD competition at the time, and the DoD competition was made by NABU or Syscom. It was judged by Oak Ridge National Lab, and the judge of that competition, Oak Ridge National Lab, ended up becoming our investor. So it was so much easier. There was not a single competition that we applied to other than we somehow end up with an investor or somehow end up with a partner. It was obviously a much bigger problem. We have noticed even that when we were not just fundraising, when we were hiring, the brightest of the brightest are more inclined to join such a problem. And hence, the business was somehow easier to run in terms of hiring and fundraising, but it was actually much harder to run in terms of engineering leadership, because you are facing a real problem. Like at this point, you become a research lab. And it was like very hard that I think we were thankful that COVID hit, because that almost tipped the scale in our favor. We were one of the very few companies that were actually happy that COVID hit. Most other cyber startups would literally fail in COVID, right? Like they've drawn out of money. That's it. That's the end of so many cyber startups that were so great. Even in our region, when we started in Waterloo, we've lost cyber startups. And it was very sad to see them go. But in our case, we were happy because we can hire the brightest and we can literally build finally. Like we don't have the market pressure of sell, because you look around and no one is selling. So we don't need to sell. We just need to finally solve a problem that is so big that people have been dragging their feet for a while trying to solve. And coincidentally, there was R&D funding. Coincidentally, we had the money raised right before COVID. It was almost like a lucky strike. And everything just lined up where we were able to finally have the time to solve it. And because the team was formed with really brilliant people, because the problem was really hard and no one solved it, we had the right people to actually solve it. And given enough time, we actually had a solution. Like we actually had a proper solution that university professors and people that we didn't think we would get the support of were like throwing support at us. And they were like, you can publish this. This is a real solution to a real problem. And there are so many things that you can do here. And at the time we were overjoyed. We would start open sourcing a bunch of it as much as possible. But it was essentially a really rewarding experience just because it was like a leap of faith in the beginning. I actually had like real revenue coming from a real product and I just had to cut the product. It's not easy to cut the product because you have to support it for a while as well. It was like a really tougher than usual experience for sure.
You mentioned about hiring the brightest. So you already had a team. So you needed to refocus the team or maybe hire new people? It's an interesting point. We spoke a bit like about other things before, but my question here is what kind of people you want to hire? Because you mentioned brightest mind. I can be very smart and very arrogant. I can be very smart and be an asshole, excuse my French. Or I can be very smart and going to be a team player. Or I'm going to be like a yes man or yes woman, whatever you want to call them, and say yes, whatever as says, or I'm going to challenge as because I have different opinions or different ways to do it. Walk me through when you say brightest mind in your mind, because for everybody, it's going to be something else.
The fact is usually in engineering, the smartest are not team players. That's just how it is. The smartest are defined not just by their objective brilliance, but almost as the persona that comes with it. So it is a tough pill to swallow, but if you have someone who is not a team player, they're likely able to survive just because they are somehow compensating that with something else, which is usually just technical brilliance. And I think the technical field is one of these very few fields where you can get away with that. You can actually survive, you can have a career by being an absolute a-hole, but you are really good at what you do because your job can allow you to work without collaborating as much as other jobs like sales or business development or HR or whatnot. Unfortunately, management was tough and I was an engineer and all of my knowledge in management was like a PMP. And at the time, it was such hard management for someone like me that I had to learn how to be a people pleaser to a certain degree. And I had to learn how to be, as Harvard puts it, after they take a lot of your money, a leader, not a manager. And usually that means just become a people pleaser. Usually that means just play to their cards. Don't play to your cards. Don't manage the team that you want to manage. Figure out essentially how not to fire them, kind of thing. And fire your dreams of how to run the team.
You're saying you need to be very dynamic.
You have to really play to their cards because you have the brilliant team. You know that they are somehow more valuable to this company than your imaginary best case scenario of management. So you just bend over pretty much. Like someone wants to see it their way, even if it's almost like an experiment that you don't really see it happening. You would let them run the experiment anyways, almost, right? You would let them go into projects that you think will fail. And just because they're brilliant, you just let them. And actually, sometimes it works. Actually, most of the times, in my experience, at least, it worked. I would butt heads with some of the senior engineers and senior researchers, and I'd let them have it their way. At the end, I just fold because I don't want to lose them. And it would turn out that they actually somehow made it work. Without any of my support, without any of the other team members' support, they would make it work just because they're arrogant. They don't want to back off. They find a way to make it work so that they have this satisfying moment of, I was right. And sometimes it's beneficial to have these kind of people.
Combination between arrogance and compliance and team players. You need to have everything.
Yeah. I think in a startup, you cannot attract a yes man. Like, you don't want to attract a yes man. And you probably cannot attract them because they want to climb a ladder. They would have so much more success at like a FANG kind of company. But if they butt heads a lot, they actually don't have that much success in a FANG. They're likely going to face some people that will hinder their success. They're likely going to have to sit with HR a lot. While in a startup, they might get away with it. So these kind of people somehow are better for you and you're better for them as a startup. You just almost need to learn how to accept that because that is your best hand as a startup. You need the brilliant people. You need the people that are likely not going to work at NVIDIA, that are likely not going to work at Google AI. And these are almost the people that can be your winning horse. These could be the people that make your startup somehow do something that NVIDIA couldn't do.
So how do you manage tasks in this chaotic environment? Basically, you almost say it's like you have a manageable chaos that you know it is because you want everybody to do what they want and move it forward. But you still have tasks. You still have priorities. You still need to sell. We talk about selling soon. But what do you do? How do you make sure whatever they go on their journey, they still come back and flow where you need to go?
It usually happens in an extremely collaborative manner. And when I say collaborative, you almost fold every time as a leader. You literally learn how to not be a manager and how to just almost be a people pleaser with the right crowd. You don't do this with someone who has 3 years of experience. You don't do this with someone who has 5 years of experience. you do this with someone who actually has the credentials. And when you sit with someone with the credentials and the experience, you essentially tell them, what we would like to have a product that does so and so. And the likely scenario from my past experiences is they stop you, they interrupt you at that sentence. And they're like, why? They question even the directions of the company. They question, why did we have that product in the first place? And your meeting that was supposed to go for 20 minutes ends up going for the whole day, because now you're explaining literally everything. You might be, and I've done this, I've taken engineers on sales validation. I've taken machine learning scientists that were extreme introverts into sales meetings so that they see what I'm talking about, just so that they can be aligned. So that when we go back to that room and we try to have that call about what, how do we get there? They're aligned. They don't fight me as much. And then finally, we would essentially go into it and we're like, what, should we do this? Should we do this? And I would do my research. I'm a little bit systematic and methodological. So I'd be like, we should follow these surveys. We should follow these papers. We should follow these works. And we would try to hash it out as scientists. But you really cannot put rank. You really have to back up everything as much as possible. We spent a lot of time, for instance, on debates where we would speculate which machine learning algorithm would work best. And I found that somehow the best solution to that was just get a supercomputer. Let's not even have the discussion, because it's very hard to have that discussion, that out of people pleasing, we would just run out of every single experiment. I've learned in this company, working with these kind of people, to just run every single experiment. Just run it all. Throw the money, get the supercomputer, run every single possible experiment. Don't speculate, right? We are scientists. We can speculate, but don't speculate. Just so that you can run a team at a very relaxing dynamic that can allow everyone to not be over vetoed kind of thing. No one gets vetoed. If you're a senior, you don't get vetoed almost ever. And that somehow works out. That somehow allows people to keep their egos, feel that freedom that they would never get elsewhere, because no other manager would be that attached to keeping such seniors. Because in a big company, you can just replace them, right? Now you're like, these are not team players. Just get rid of them. In a small startup, you keep them because they are your winning horse.
You mentioned sales. So let's jump to sales. You mentioned also that you're an engineer by trade in the beginning.
Yeah.
So walk me how you shift your mind from engineering to sales. And then later on, how do you let go from your baby and let somebody else sell it? Because you need to let go in one point. You cannot do it all the time.
I don't know if I got there yet. I don't know if I let go yet. Until now, I struggle with letting go, for sure. Because maybe I'm still early in the transition into being a complete hands-off leader. But so far, I'm really attached to the baby. But yeah, in terms of transitioning to sales, it was tough. Like, I was not really a good salesperson. I remember in many of the company employees, remember, I was pitching something in, I think, 2016 for the early version of the UTM device. And I got stage fright. We paid a lot of money for a stage in McMaster Innovation Park. And we had a booth and everything. And I got on the stage and I had to deliver something after the keynote. And I got real stage fright. Like, I had notes written on my hand and my hand got sweaty and the notes all got smushed up. And I couldn't even say a single word. They were just slurring my words and people couldn't understand anything. And my co-founders at the time, they were like, just calm down. Just save yourself the embarrassment. You're going to faint or something. But yeah, it was not easy. I remember at the time, some of the mentors, there's a mentor called Eric Spearin at the time. He had a successful exit. He had an analytics company that he sold. Now he's the president of a humongous trucking company. And he's just doing so good for himself because he was a really natural and talented salesperson. He's just like an incredible person. And at the time, I was like, Eric, listen, I'm literally the opposite of you. You got to help me. And he was kind enough. He actually sat me down. He's like, listen, what's the hardest thing? Calling people. That's too hard. That's too cold calls. You're going to fail 99% of your cold calls. Just do them. And he just sat there, literally took a whole day, and he would just sit down and he'd be like, let's call. Sure, let's do it. And I would start the call and I would completely, essentially my confidence at the time. And we'd do another one, And that kept on going for weeks until finally someone said, you guys are that close, just come talk to me. And we jumped in our cars and we drove through downtown. Both of our cars just went there and we parked and we went down, and that was an MSSP at the time in Hamilton, Ontario. And we just sat down with that MSSP, and Eric essentially just sat there and he was like introducing me. He was like, the CEO of our company has a little presentation. And I was completely remote to me as an engineer. And I just sat there with my little presentation with all the technical terms. And I was just like, I had my laptop. I couldn't even talk without a laptop. I said, went there to a freaking sales meeting with my laptop and I turned it to them. And I was just like hitting the button. It was like extremely pathetic, but it is what it is. It takes a lot of failures for an engineer to become a salesperson. It's almost like when you get a salesperson, you're like, write me some Python code. Like it probably wouldn't.
What can you recommend to the engineers that want to have their own company? So basically people that's similar to you in a way of the engineering mind, can you give them some ideas, some hints, like what helped you? Or maybe what would you differently and actually going to do this journey?
Interesting. I don't know what I would do differently. I've always had this perfect company in my head. It's an engineer and a salesperson. All of the engineers are working remotely. It's super freaking cheap. All of the salespeople are working in California. Theoretically, I had the best plan. It's not easy, right? I have hired remote teams where they were cheap. I have had a sales partner. I don't know. I don't think, like, it's well known in business, like you write the business plan because you write your wishes. They usually don't happen. You can write your business plan. I can give you advice, but it's unlikely that it will unfold that way. My advice would just be play to your hand. Just figure out what you have. You might have the connection. You might have the cousin. You might have the character that allows you to be a good salesperson on other engineers in your class. Just play to your hand. Figure out what is your skill set. What is your passion? What is your slightly easier thing to do than people would? Maybe I didn't know how to manage my relationships as best as someone else can. Maybe I didn't know how to be a salesperson as better as someone else could. Yeah, I think play to your hand. You have to almost do a self-reflection thing because you are the company when you're starting. The company is not the idea. The company is not the team. It's just the founder. You are the company. So sit down and reflect. What does this company have? What is it that could be your competitive advantage? And play to that. Forget that the company has to have a sales team. Maybe your company does not need a sales team. Maybe you're one of these companies where you actually don't sell. It's a company that lives on, I don't know, grants or lives on sponsorships or lives on a single non-government organization check every year that you just apply to. It might be. Like, just play to your hand. A lot of the advice might be frustrating. If I were to give myself advice, I would be saying that I could probably lean more into sales earlier than I did. But yeah, if I were to go back and tell myself some advice, I'd be like, sell something when you were in college. Sell something. It doesn't have to be anything crazy. Just sell whatever. And you'd probably fail a lot, but it's a good skill to have for myself. It was something that I should have worked on earlier.
You mentioned several times it's not easy. And this is not something, this is repeating Everest. All the people that I'm talking to say it's not easy. What do you personally do to yourself, basically to get back, to become easier, to go reflect, work out, and I don't know, maybe meditate?
I definitely try to do better in this area. I don't think I have good self-care routine. I think I burn out a lot, but I've established a tolerance, and I think it is my competitive advantage. Like, I think I don't burn out as often as other people do. Like, I just have a better resilience, maybe biologically. But yeah, I just leaned down onto that. I became the person that works the most for a while. Only recently did I start appreciating not becoming the bottleneck of the company. I think that is something that I suffered from a lot. I was the bottleneck of the company. When I burn out, the company literally becomes a shit show. Recently, I've appreciated that maybe I shouldn't work as hard and I should manage more and I should lead more than work, because then I can burn out and I can literally disappear and somehow this company will still be a company. How do I guess make things easier for myself? I think I'm fortunate to have a very tight family. I'm originally Middle Eastern, so the Middle East is well known for very tight family relationships. Although I don't live with my family. My family is all across the pond in the UK and in Egypt and whatnot. It's almost like culture that I have to visit every year, and that allows me to decompress almost. That allows me to zoom out from the company and see that, you know what, there is a nephew, there is a niece, there's a sister, there's other stuff. It allows me to decompress. For sure. I don't have a lot of success decompressing elsewhere. I go to the gym and I'm very well known for this because all of my offices have gyms and I would go to the gym with my employees and I'd be stuck on my phone in the gym. I'd be sitting in the gym on a chest press machine and I'm on a Zoom call or I'm texting or I'm researching something in a meeting and I just take meetings in the freaking gym and I initiate meetings in the gym.
It's actually a very unique skill. You're the first one to tell me about it.
Yeah, I've never successfully went to the gym to decompress. I find that as extreme remote advice. I cannot turn off my mind at the gym. It actually works better. It almost allows me to step out of my office and get fresh ideas. When I watch YouTube videos about like these CEOs that go and work out for 6 hours in the morning, I'm like, I'd be working for these 6 hours in the morning. I'd go on the run, I would stop in the middle of the bridge and I would be like, huh, I didn't think about that. Interesting. Wait, let me call this guy. I cannot turn it off. It actually works better when I'm working out.
As thank you very much. Time flew very fast. A lot of interesting ideas. I think a lot of also creative and good advice for people who want to start their own company. And I have a feeling that your customers, your future customers, are going to listen to this and going to understand more about you and your very warm person and warm personality. So all the success and good luck. What are you doing?
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here and I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody that's listening. Thank you very much. We'll tune in the next episode. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.